The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Sarah Crown.
Hello and welcome to our Easter-themed edition. After missing out on the Orange Prize shortlisting, Jennifer Egan turns a frown upside down and walks away with a Pulitzer.
You know, to me, experimentation as serving anything other than a human story is boring, and I'm not interested in it. But if you're willing to be playful with form and structure, what I have found is that you can tell more interesting and complex stories than you can tell conventionally.
With the break in mind, we'll be talking about the best books for children to take away for the holiday. Michelle Pawley visits the Just Imagine Story Centre in Chelmsford.
Wow, that looks fantastic. Tell me a bit more about your monster.
Well, his pus bots explode on enemies to dissolve them. Suction in the mouth creates a black hole. Also related to The Godfather, and lives in clouds, otherwise known as steam baths.
And David Lodge washes H.G. Wells' dirty linen in public.
I've got some fun, I think, out of his relationship with Dorothy Richardson, the novelist, who was always criticising his prose style and who he actually employed to correct his manuscripts and improve them.
Spring is truly in the air, and this is the Guardian Books Podcast. First up is the news this week that Jennifer Egan has won this year's Pulitzer Prize for fiction. Her book, A Visit from the Goon Squad, is at heart the story of two characters, Benny, a disillusioned record producer, and his young assistant, Sasha. The book charts their journeys from childhood and adolescent excess through the complexities of adult life. The Goon Squad is the name one character gives to time, and this is a book that's all about time's passage. As The Guardian's reviewer Sarah Churchwell put it, Goon Squad is a book about memory and kinship, time and narrative, continuity and disconnection, in which relationships shift and recombine kaleidoscopically. That's the substance, but this is also a book with style. And when Claire Armitstead spoke to Jennifer Egan recently, she started by asking her why she chose to write an entire chapter as a PowerPoint presentation.
I was very interested in PowerPoint for reasons I wasn't even completely sure of. One of them was that I knew that I wanted each chapter to be very different from all of the others technically, so that pushed me in some pretty extreme directions because I had done third person and second person and first person and multiple points of view. But I think really once I was working in PowerPoint, what I discovered is that PowerPoint is a genre that's really built around distinct moments, atomized moments with pauses in between. That's literally how it functions. And in a way, that's exactly the same principle that my book is built around. You know, we visit these people in specific, vivid moments of their lives, but a lot of what transpires happens in between. So it's a book that's really built around pauses. When I was working in PowerPoint, I felt like it was the moment that I could kind of lay bare the strategy of the book and make it manifest in a way that was very satisfying.
Just to bring you back right to the start of that chapter, it's headed Great Rock and Roll Pauses by Alison Blake, who's Alison. Tell us about the pauses. This is Lincoln, her autistic brother's obsession, isn't it?
Yes, he's sort of Asperger's obsessed with the pauses in rock and roll songs.
Such as? What sort of rock and roll songs?
Young Americans by David Bowie, Roxanne by The Police. I actually got the idea from a book that I read called So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star by a drummer named Jacob Schlichter, who was with the band Semisonic. They had a mega hit, I actually know it was very popular here too, called Closing Time in 1998, which has a pause in it. And in his book, in his memoir, he talks about how that pause came to be. Their producer or mixer was a guy named Bob Clearmountain, who was known for inserting dramatic pauses into songs. They were called Clearmountain Pauses, believe it or not. So as soon as I read that, I thought, oh my God, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, it's so interesting to me. And I think in a way, you know, this is a book about time, and you're never more aware of time passing than in those moments when it seems to stop, and that's what a pause is. So the pause in a song makes you think maybe the song is over. You're sort of waiting for the pause to end, and then the song rushes back in, and that makes you feel all sorts of things. Anyway, so Lincoln lectures his family endlessly on these pauses, and his father in particular goes ballistic. And so Allison captures all of that in her PowerPoint presentation. Some of the slides are devoted to just Lincoln's opinion on various pauses. Some of them he thinks are too short. He thinks David Bowie's pause in Young American is sort of wimpy. And other ones he thinks are perfect. Like he loves the pause in Long Train Runnin' by the Doobie Brothers. There are pauses all over the place. And I have to say, readers have continued to send me more information on pauses since the book was published.
Are you a real geek?
I'm actually not. I think I get a little geeky on this topic, though. I hear it in my voice. I knew I was achieving real geekhood when I found myself spending hours timing the pauses so that I could analyze exactly how long they were.
The important thing about this novel for me is it sounds terribly postmodern. There will probably be people here who say, I'll never touch that. But actually, it's incredibly human, isn't it? It's almost a soap opera in that you're following a known group of people through a long period of their lives.
You know, to me, all experimentation as serving anything other than a human story is boring, and I'm not interested in it. But if you're willing to be playful with form and structure, what I have found is that you can tell more interesting and complex stories than you can tell conventionally. You know, it's funny, I think that PowerPoint chapter is probably one of the sweetest kind of overtly sentimental pieces of writing that I've done.
It's so adorable. She goes off into the desert with her dad, and her dad's having real problems dealing with her brother, and she obviously understands her brother much better than her dad does. It is very sweet, I have to say.
I think it would be a little too sweet as conventional fiction. I think it would feel kind of like I was milking the emotions, but I think the coldness and the corporate feeling of PowerPoint in a way undercuts the sweetness, and in the same way, the sweetness kind of offsets that corporate feeling. So they managed to coexist.
Now, one last thing is there is a political strand to this, isn't there? At one point, there's a trip off to an African country to try and legitimize a genocidal leader.
Yes, the idea is that this third world dictator who's, you know, murdered many wants to rehabilitate his reputation, so he hires a publicist. She starts by putting him in a fuzzy hat, and rather immediately, his reputation begins to improve. Suddenly, the people are questioning whether the opposition had been paid and whether he really killed as many people as they thought. And then her next big idea is that he would be linked to a movie star. And the kind of irony of the story really is that in a way, he ultimately is rehabilitated, because once he's linked to the movie star, the paparazzi just surrounds him, and there's kind of no escape from them. And suddenly, he basically has to play it straight, and he ends up speaking at the UN. I mean, this is satire, of course, but, you know, always there has to be a kind of serious underside to that.
Jennifer Egan, winner of the 2011 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Now, we put an extract of A Visit from the Goon Squad up on our children's book site, and I'm joined by the editor of the site, Michelle Pauly, in the studio. Michelle, why did we have an extract from a book that's won a Pulitzer Prize for Fiction on a children's website?
Well, it sounds unusual, but the extract we chose is a chapter of the book, which is the diary of a teenager, and it's done entirely as PowerPoint slides. We wanted to find out from our teenage readers whether that form of storytelling works for them, whether they found it convincing.
And did they?
There was a mixed reaction. It's not a book for everyone. It's not a style of storytelling for everyone. And there were some pretty scathing comments from some of the teenagers. For example, D'Artagnan says, "It is very brave to do something so different, but I don't really think it works. Reading 76 pages of continuous slides is tedious."
Okay, that's... it's not even damning with faint praise. Did anyone like it?
Yes, I'd say it was about half and half. And there was a comment from Peter who said, "Yes, it works. And it's pretty magical. In some strange way, it more deliberately forces one to fill in the gaps from one's own experience, literally reading between the lines, or the slides, perhaps."
Okay, so either way, it's obviously a book that's getting people talking, and I guess the point is that you have to just go away, read it, and form your own opinion on it. A Visit from the Goon Squad is available from the Guardian Bookshop, and details are on our website.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Sarah Crown.
Now, even when the weather's as glorious as it has been this week, children can end up getting bored in the school holidays. And I gather, Michelle, that you've uncovered a way of entertaining them. Story centres, what are they?
Story centres are a fairly recent and really interesting phenomenon. The best known example, I'm sure you've heard of this, is Ministry of Stories in London, which is based on the whole Dave Eggers Centre in America and has now been brought over here. And it's set up as a monster store, so you go in and you don't really realise what you're getting into, because it's a place where you can buy all kinds of gooey, horrible things. But you go through a door and there's the story centre, and kids learn to write. They have authors coming in, helping them to read and to write. And it's a great idea.
Are they open to any kids just walking in off the street, or do you have to book?
They vary. So there's a new one that's opened in Chelmsford Chelmsford called Just Imagine, and I think we're going to be hearing a bit more about that. And that has some set events, so it has workshops, it has authors doing readings, and some of those things you have to book for. But there's also space there where you can just go and read, and they've got a bookshop, and there's all kinds of lovely things to see and do, and I just think they're a great idea.
Sounds absolutely fantastic. If there'd been one around when I was on Easter holidays, which we don't really get anymore, I would definitely have gone.
Well, I suppose we had libraries when we were kids.
Yes, not so many of those anymore.
So I went to visit one of these centres that opened recently, Just Imagine in Chelmsford, and you can find out a bit more about it. But be warned, there are screaming children right from the outset. It was a noisy day.
Unless I want you to shout out, can you shout? Can you shout?
I'm Nikki Gamble, and I've just set up Just Imagine, which is an independent children's bookshop and story centre. So it's not just about being a bookshop, it's also a space where there'll be lots of events, lots of happenings based around children's books. And then downstairs in our basement, Sarah McIntyre is the illustrator of Morris the Mankiest Monster. Steve Cole, author of the Astrosaur series, have been having a monster-tastic workshop where they've been creating Top Trump monster cards. Those are going to be reproduced, the artwork, and they're going to be used to decorate our stairwell.
Wow, that looks fantastic. Tell me a bit more about your monster.
It's a half-man, half-octopus. His pus spots explode on enemies to dissolve them. Suction in the mouth creates a black hole and creates illusions to trick you. Also related to the Godfather, and lives in clouds, otherwise known as steam baths.
I am Steve Cole. I write quite a lot of children's books. I'm very happy to be here at Just Imagine because I've got about 10 or 11 new books out this year, and it's nice to have somewhere with some shelf space to put them.
There seems to have been a particular rise in these story centres at the moment. You've got Ministry of Stories in London and Seven Stories in Newcastle, and now Just Imagine here in Chelmsford. Why now? Why do you think there's a particular demand for these story centres?
Well, I think it's, in a way, as we're living in a time where the media itself is changing and the rise of e-books and lots of bookshops finding that sales are kind of being channeled through websites rather than the traditional bookstores, I think people are realising that it's not just about selling books, it's about kind of fostering a kind of a community of getting people into books and into reading, into writing, improving those skills and just encouraging them. I think it offers more of a way to reach out to a wider spectrum. Like, the smell of books, you know, there's something so much more tangible about them in a place like this.
We do know that we're in a situation where services are being cut. I was quite keen to continue to develop capacity for creative learning and to have a space where that could happen.
And I do quite a lot of school events, for example, and you do get children who put their hands up and say, can I go into a bookshop wearing trainers? Do I have to wear smart shoes? They have this idea that books are these dusty things and that all authors should be wearing, like, you know, dinner suits. And I think just finding that actual writers are alive can be quite inspiring to children. I think there's a lot of them, sort of like, it seems a remote thing that they don't grasp it until you go along and talk to them about writing, how easy it is to come up with ideas for stories. And once you find the right story, that will hopefully start them off on a lifelong love of reading and realising that, you know, it's not a chore. It can be a lot of fun.
The Just Imagine Story Centre is open this Saturday and Easter Monday. There's a link to all the information on our website if you look underneath the page where this podcast is sitting. But if you can't make it to Chelmsford, don't worry. There are plenty of other ways to keep your children entertained this Easter. Michelle, can you give us a taste of what new releases there are out there for children?
Well, there's a couple of biggies that have just been released. Well, one has just been released. One is coming in a week. The first one is the last in the Alex Rider series by Anthony Horowitz. It's called Scorpio Rising. That's out now. It's already a big seller. And coming up is the new Rick Riordan, who is just huge amongst the sort of 8 to 12 age group. And this,
I don't know anything about him. Tell me a bit about him.
Well, he's known for the Percy Jackson series, and it's all about mythology and half gods and gods. And the new one is set in Egypt. It's a second in the Cain Chronicles series. And given how huge Rick is, that book's going to be huge as well.
Yeah. So that's sort of covering the early teenage base, but what about for readers who are a little bit younger, sort of 8 to 12? What books are out there for them at the minute?
Well, I think Easter is a great time to get lost in an adventure. I always think of Easter as being kind of classic Famous Five or Secret Seven time when you go off into the countryside or the seaside. Yes, and have
just long enough, isn't it? 2 weeks is about enough time to solve a crime.
Exactly. And that's exactly what happens in Dead Man's Cove by Lauren St. John. It's the first in her Laura Marlin series. And Laura Marlin is just this fantastic new heroine that I think everyone is going to love. She's obviously an orphan. She's in a children's home because all good adventure stories start like that. And she goes off to live with her uncle in Cornwall and has a huge adventure. And it's got the sort of Enid Blyton overtones to it, you know, even the title Dead Man's Cove. Mm. But it's still kind of modern. She's a modern heroine. The plot involves people smuggling, which is, you know, quite contemporary. And it's just a great read, I think, for whatever age you are.
Anything else for that age group?
Well, there's an interesting debut that's just come out called Skyhawk by Jill Lewis, and that's set in Scotland, and that's a nature story. And that's been really highly praised by Michael Morpurgo, the former Children's Laureate, who said it's a page-turner, you can't put it down.
Yeah, it's a stamp of approval to have.
It is, and it's a lovely nature story.
We've talked a lot about serieses, if that is in fact a word. I can remember an amazing Easter holiday that I had where I read the whole of Susan Cooper's The Dark is Rising series sort of in one go. And that all starts off in Cornwall as well, actually, in sort of sunny summer holiday, I think it is there. Do you think that a series is a good thing to buy a kid who's feeling a bit bored?
Definitely. And again, I think Easter is a great time for, say, a trilogy because, you know, the Christmas holidays, there's loads of exciting stuff going on and you can't just bury yourself away and read. Summer, you've got to go away with your parents and things like that. Whereas Easter is just, I think, a great reading time. And it's a good time to catch up on some trilogies. I mean, I really rate the trilogy Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. It's going to be a film soon. There's quite a lot of controversy over the casting of it at the moment. So now is a good time to read it before the film comes out.
Ruins it.
Exactly. And that's for a slightly older age group. That's probably teenagers. And it's just incredibly gripping. Mm. And if you're going to buy it for a kid, buy them all three in one go, because it's unfair to give them one and then leave them hanging on. You could also catch up on Patrick Ness's Chaos Walking trilogy, The Ask and the Answer, The Knife of Never Letting Go, and Monsters of Men. Monsters of Men is up for the Arthur C. Clarke Award next week. So,
well, that's an adult award, isn't it?
It is. And it is this is one for, again, for teenagers, 13 plus. It's a bit gory in places, I should warn you, but it's a fantastic read.
Now, we've covered teenagers then and the younger age group, 8 to 12-year-olds, but my son's only 3 and he's probably a little bit young for Patrick Ness as yet. So is there anything, I mean, we're really now getting into the territory of recommending books for parents to buy for children, but is there anything that you'd suggest that I could buy for him to take away? We're off on holiday next week and it would be nice to have something to entertain him.
Ah, well, considering it's Easter, you can't get much more of a sort of classic Easter read for that age group than Peter Rabbit. And Penguin have just brought out some new Peter Rabbit books for that age group and also a bit younger. There's Happy Easter, Peter, very appropriately, book, which has got all kinds of fun pull-out bits.
Oh, yes, we've got it here. Brilliant.
Yeah, have a look at that. There's the Peter Rabbit finger puppet book, which is ever so cute. And there's The Tale of a Naughty Little Rabbit, which is based on the original Beatrix Potter tale. Of course, you can always go back to the originals as well. But this is a larger format with big pictures, and I reckon that would go down a treat.
Yeah, that looks absolutely perfect. I might borrow it off you later. Brilliant. Thank you.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Sarah Crown.
Time now to explore another theme of Easter, fertility. H.G. Wells may not spring to mind as a sexual icon, but he was practicing free love at the point when D.H. Lawrence was only writing about it. And now David Lodge has released a factual novel about Wells. It's called A Man of Parts, and it explores the author's many loves and losses. It's the kind of story that makes you expect a BBC Two adaptation in the autumn. When I spoke to David about the book, I began by asking how he could presume to know so much about the intimate details of Wells's life.
Wells himself wrote a secret postscript to his published autobiography, which was the story of his sexual life. And he instructed his son that it should be published after he and all the women mentioned in it were dead. The fact that he said that suggests to me that he did want it to be considered as a part of his life. He wanted people to know. It's not a great book in itself. It's somewhat fragmentary, but it was absolutely priceless to me because I couldn't presume to invent liaisons or, you know, imagine which women he went to bed with if I didn't know for sure. So, yes, I mean, in a way, that is the spine of the book, is the sequence of relationships with about four or five women in particular. I think, in a way, this, if you're going to write a novel, you're naturally drawn to the private, emotional, secret life, if you like, because the public life or the literary life is already fully discussed in biographies, and you have nothing much to add to that, really. But to put the two together, perhaps, is illuminating.
One of the things that's so striking as a reader of the story is how many connections there are with Wells to other authors. I mean, Henry James himself was a friend, crops up quite a lot. And I wondered whether, when I was reading it, I wondered if you'd encountered Wells via James, but no.
No, I encountered Wells very early. My parents gave me the collected stories of H.G. Wells for Christmas when I was about 14, I think. Mm-hmm. I guess it was their idea of a great author, you know.
Is it your idea of a great author?
Well, yeah, I think he is a great author, although he always, you know, attacked the idea of greatness, actually, specifically. I think he's a great figure, intellectual figure. I'm not sure he's a really great novelist because he wasn't interested ultimately in artistic perfection.
That's something that comes through really strongly in the book because certainly the way that you've constructed him, he seems to dash off these pieces of work quite quickly, often because he's a bit strapped for cash. But where his mind is really is either on women or politics most of the time.
Yes, I think that's true. He did take pains over some of his work, early work particularly, but more and more he used to describe himself as a journalist, you know, and he recognised that he wouldn't be admired by the literati because he wrote too quickly. I've got some fun, I think, out of his relationship with Dorothy Richardson, the novelist, who was always criticising his prose style and who he actually employed to correct his manuscripts, you know, and improve them.
Yeah, there's a lovely passage where she's, I think they've maybe just had sex, and then she starts to edit him.
Yeah, sitting up in bed. She's stark naked, with her, except for her pince-nez, and telling him what's wrong with this sentence. Yeah. Yes, I enjoyed writing that.
One of the things that I thought, again, when I was reading the book, something that stood out for me was that when we think about Wells these days generally, or when people who aren't Wells aficionados think about him, they think about The War of the Worlds, The Time Machine, The Invisible Man, all of these books that happened very early on in his writing career. And in your novel, you just pass over them in an instant, really. You don't sort of spend a lot of time interrogating them. And I wondered what you thought he would think about this being the basis for his ongoing fame.
Well, I think he was proud of the early science fiction, but I wanted really to tell readers about books they might not know about, and I could take for granted they knew what the War of the Worlds was like, you know. But maybe Ann Veronica, they didn't. I think he, like many writers, was somewhat disappointed in his old age, part because his reputation had declined, the quality of his books had declined as he got older, and inevitably he fell out of literary fashion. I mean, he was still a prominent member of the literary establishment, but he wasn't in the swim, as it were, in the fashionable kinds of writing in the 30s and 40s. So he was very ironic at his own expense about the eclipse of his reputation in his old age, and that was partly why I decided to frame the story with the last years of his life, so you got some sense of his looking back and remembering his great success. Somerset Maugham used to come and visit him, apparently, and would read the newspapers to him. Maugham says he would always ask, "Is there anything about me in the paper?" And Somerset Maugham said, "And there never was," which is rather sad.
Of course, the thing for you with the Henry James novel, now famously, is that your novel, Author, came out just a couple of weeks away from...
No, 6 months after.
Six months.
That was the devil of it.
6 months after Colm Tóibín published his book, The Master. Yeah. Were you on tenterhooks when you were writing this one, wondering if anyone else was doing the same thing?
Well, I tell you, I had the idea immediately after finishing Author, and I thought, I can't do this. I can't bear the prospect of being scooped again twice in succession. So I deliberately kind of put the idea aside. I wrote Death Sentence instead. But then I came back because I was drawn to the subject and I thought, well, nobody's done it. And I didn't think Wells was quite as an attractive subject as Henry James, who seems to attract biographical novelists like a jar of honey attracts bees. So I took a risk, really, that nobody else was thinking of doing it.
You've now written two biographical novels.
Yeah.
What does the novel bring to biography that a straight biography doesn't have?
The biographer, modern biography, which is based on evidence. Self-respecting biographers do not invent or imagine things. They keep to what is documented. This inevitably means there are huge gaps. And I think the novelist can imagine and fill in those gaps. I mean, my way of working in this genre is to respect the known facts, but to use my imagination to join them up, as it were. I don't think it in any way competes with biography. If you really want, the facts, then you go to biography. But I think it can give a sense of the life as lived through novelistic techniques. In a biography, inevitably, the dominant style is the voice of the biographer. I mean, most of the words come from that source. But with a biographical novel, through dialogue scenes and through the technique of free and direct style, giving the consciousness of the character, you can bring a novelistic sort of illusion to representing the intimate experiences of the character. But it is a controversial form, but also a very popular form.
You talked about the fact that, we all know The War of the Worlds, we all know The Time Machine, but there are other great Wells novels that perhaps are less well known. Which one would you suggest to people to start with if they want to encounter a Wells who they haven't met yet?
Well, I think his best novel from a literary point of view is one called Tono Bungay, which is a rather off-putting title. It happens to be the name of a patent medicine that makes the fortune of one of the characters. But it's a very impressive, what I would call a Condition of England novel. It's a very powerfully written book, and I think he took a lot of pains over it. He thought that was his best novel by conventional literary standards, and I would agree with that.
David Lodge. A Man of Parts is available from The Guardian Bookshop, and details are on our website. And that's almost it for this week. In The Guardian Review tomorrow, Royal Wedding Fever reigns. Jackie Kay, Roger McGough and Michael Simmons Roberts are among the poets who join Caroline Duffy to offer their vows to be read at weddings. And on guardian.co.uk/books this week, Robert Irwin offers his top 10 quest narratives and Kathy Cassidy answers children's questions on the latest children's site video. Next week on the podcast, we'll be looking at sporting books, including The Cambridge Companion to Cricket and The Bicycle Book by Bella Bathurst. And if you have any suggestions of your own favourites, please do post them into the comments below this podcast. My thanks to Michelle Pawley and Claire Armistead. The producer continues to be Matt Hill, while Tim Mabey enjoys another rain-free week out. My name's Sarah Crown. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.